God save the United States and its honorable court. Case number 07-2127, Price Fund et al., Appellant, Office of County Oversight Board et al., Mr. Carter, City Appellant, Mr. Glassman for Appellate DCAOB, and Mr. Stern for Appellate USA.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, Michael Carvin for the appellants. PCAOB is a plain violation of separation of powers under a straightforward application of Morrison versus Olson. Conversely, if this unique and unprecedented agency is upheld, it will eviscerate any cognizable concept of genuine executive power. The test is very straightforward under Morrison. It was repeated about five times. Do the restrictions, particularly the removal restrictions, impermissibly burden the president's ability to control and supervise those who are executing the law? Whatever impermissibly burden means, here the president's ability has been utterly eliminated. Congress could have satisfied the Morrison test by simply vesting the board's power in a traditional independent agency or making the board a traditional independent regulatory agency. But it wasn't satisfied with that. It wanted yet another layer of separation between the executive and the executive power. So it went beyond the outermost boundary, and it stripped the president of all the methods of control that he has over independent agencies. In every independent agency, the president appoints and can remove the commissioners. He was stripped of those two vital functions under this. He can neither appoint nor remove anybody on the board. Even the SEC's power to remove people on the board can't be based on the notion that the board is pursuing a completely wrong-headed policy under federal law. They can only
That's really your theory, right, that it's two levels of for-cause removal away from the president, as I understand it.
And that's exactly right, Jeff.
And is there any, are you aware of any precedent for something like that?
There's no precedent, in Your Honor, for any notion of this agency, because, again, this is a unique adventure by Congress.
Independent agency within an independent agency.
Yes, I would say an independent agency outside of an independent agency, but it's the same thought.
And well, that's on the principal officer.
Yeah. To encapsulate the point, the president can't, on pain of removal, tell the SEC commissioners to pursue his policy judgments, no matter how wrongheaded he thinks the SEC's policy is. And in addition, the SEC can't tell the board to pursue its policy preferences or its enforcement policies upon pain of removal. So there's simply no way that the president, given those two completely insurmountable barriers, can in any way enforce his judgment or his priorities on the board's very important law enforcement functions. And if the president can't do that, then obviously the people have no check over those exercising coercive power against them, because the president is the only one that's accountable to the democratic process. So you have the precise evil that separation of powers was designed to prevent. And the appellants recognize all this. They recognize they can't make any cognizable argument that the president can really influence enforcement policy, so they focus obsessively on the SEC's alleged ability to supervise the board. They exaggerate it, and it's wrong, but the
Is there any relevance that you and your amici have talked about the encroachment on presidential power? Is it of any relevance that the president here, as represented by the Justice Department, apparently disagrees?
It's no relevance, Your Honor. I mean, there's an unfortunate or certainly tradition of presidents signing bills which do encroach on their power. President Reagan signed the Ethics in Government Act. President Nixon signed the law that was at issue in Buckley, et cetera, et cetera. In Freitag, the government defended what was certainly an arguable incursion on presidential power. And in none of the Supreme Court opinions do you see any suggestion that's of relevance, because, of course, we're trying to protect the office of the president, not the current occupant. And just as when Congress presumably gives away some of its power under line item veto, they're not going to bound future Congresses to that unconstitutional thing, nor can a president bind his successors to sacrificing what his core executive powers.
Would you agree that under the statute, the board can take no final action absent the commission's approval?
No, we would disagree with that. There's three functions that the board performs, Your Honor. Obviously, the most important one is its enforcement function through its investigation and inspections.
What section of the statute do you rely on?
Well, the one outlining the board's duties, where it gives
Where does it say the board can make final decisions independent of the commission?
Well, under 6A in the statutory appendum 101-72-1, the duties of the board, and then it lists in 101C, register public accounting firms, C is conduct.
Well, let me ask you this, so you understand the thrust of my argument. Would it make a difference to your argument if the board lacked authority to take any final action under the statute?
Your Honor.
Absent commission approval.
It depends what we're talking about in terms of final action. We don't dispute that in exercising their rulemaking function and their adjudicatory function, that the SEC can veto what the board does.
All right. So you're using the word adjudicatory function as I'm using the word final action?
We're right, but there's all kinds of things that have a final impact. All prosecutors have a final impact on people by investigating them, inspecting them, making reports about them. Now, no prosecutor can take final action in the sense of securing a conviction or ultimate sanctions, but my point is the prosecutorial function is completely immune from any kind of SEC review, even a veto power.
Once the commission approves a rule, any authority allowed to the board under that rule is impermissible under your separation of powers thesis?
I'm not sure I'm following Your Honor's question.
Well, your argument is, as I understand it, you're drawing a distinction between the final judgment and prosecutorial authority, such as, I assume you mean, investigation,
yes.
Examination.
That's right.
So that if the rules that the commission approves authorize that, you're saying that that would be a violation of the separation of powers?
I am saying that the ability to do all the kinds of things that law enforcement agencies do every day, decide who to investigate, how to investigate them, without any review. This court has said that that kind of inspection is a core executive function.
Without any review
of
what? Day-to-day, moment-by-moment?
Well, let's use the two most obvious examples. My client, Bechstead & Watts, was subjected to an inspection investigation. There was nothing that the SEC could tell the board, drop the Bechstead & Watts investigation. If, conversely, the board said, you know, we don't think Enron or its accountants did anything wrong and dropped that investigation, there is absolutely no statutory mechanism for the board to decide whether or not wrongdoers go free or innocent people are unduly burdened. I do acknowledge that in terms of the rules establishing the inspections, investigations, these sort of majestic generalities are subject to SEC approval. Implementation and application of that core prosecutorial function is wholly outside the scope
of the
SEC.
Just to make sure I understand, the SEC can't direct the board to investigate someone, some entity that the board does not want to investigate.
That's entirely correct. Now, just to be clear, the Justice Department, I don't think the board is making this argument, suggests that there's some general rulemaking authority in 3A of the Act, and that the SEC somehow could pass a rule and then tell them to drop or not. But that's clearly untrue.
Actually, I just read that to be a rule that to drop. I didn't even see that as their suggestion, which I saw as well, to be that they could require an investigation, although maybe they would go that far.
And that's, of course, the essential point. I don't think they're arguing that. The rulemaking function they're referring to is totally about the SEC's functions under the Act. The SEC has no power, for example, to require auditors to register. That's the board's function. So the SEC can't usurp the board's function. And yes, it's purely a veto power. They can stop them from doing bad things. What they can't do is direct them to do good things or go after people who need going after. And that's the essential impediment to the core function.
Can I ask you one question on your general separation of powers removal theory as distinct from the principal versus inferior theory? You seem to be arguing that the president constitutionally must have the power to remove inferior officers in independent agencies.
He has to have the ability. We do acknowledge that.
Even though you concede that, I think you concede that he doesn't have to have constitutionally the power to remove inferior officers in executive agencies.
Of course, 2 points. One is, under current statutory regimes, there are no inferior officers that are not removable by the president because in the executive branch agencies,
Because the alter ego.
But
technically,
but
the president wanted to remove the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs. The way it would have to work would be an order to the Secretary of State.
Right, that's entirely true, and we completely concede that. But our point is that there's no infringement on his powers, because he calls the Secretary of State, says fire the Deputy Assistant to Secretary of State. It's done like that. Now, let's think about an analogous situation with the SEC. He has a conference
call. And that's based on Hennen and the Hennen line, right?
Well, their theory, we don't dispute that Congress can vest the removal authority in a presidential alter ego, because that doesn't infringe on the president's ability. The only difference is whether the president calls the
inferior. But it is a little odd to say, and this is separate from your two levels removed theory, as uh-huh. I understand it, but it's a little odd to say the president constitutionally must have the power to directly remove inferior officers and independent agencies when he doesn't have that power to directly remove inferior officers and executive agencies.
If I'm understanding your honor correctly, he has to have, there's two steps, right? The alter ego, he can simply say, fire the person, and that doesn't infringe.
I think your answer is just the alter ego makes that.
The alter ego is certainly that, but I do want to point out that, for example, if we're calling people within the SEC inferior officers, they are completely creatures of the commission. There's no congressional statutes or anything, which leads the board to argue that they're not even inferior officers. But even if they are inferior officers, remember, the president appoints the chairman of the SEC, and the chairman of the SEC serves at his pleasure. So Chris Cox's alter egos, if you will, are all that are inferior officers. So constitutionally, they're indistinguishable from Chris Cox. That being so, if the president, as he does, exercises sufficient control over the chairmanship, then the chairman's alter egos also fall within the constitutional bound. And so we wouldn't have problems.
Must an alter ego be a single individual under the Constitution?
We wouldn't argue that that stems from separation of powers. We would argue that that comes from the word head. But that aside, if you had two people who were running a cabinet department who were both alter egos of the president, it would be an unwieldy management structure. But I don't know, absent more precise specifics in the hypothetical, that alone would create a separation of powers issue.
On the principal officer versus inferior, after Edmund, is the test essentially whether the officer is at will or for cause, or is there more to it?
Well, I would say that was clearly what Edmund said was the most important method of control, and they attach great significance to the fact that the judge.
So if you're subject only to for cause removal, it's hard to be. It's unclear where the line is, but it's hard to be an inferior officer if you're subject only to for cause removal.
Part of the problem with sort of treating the board as inferior officers is, of course, the appointments clause and the separation of powers were supposed to work in conjunction. No one ever envisioned this freestanding agency that doesn't report to anybody in an organizational chart as being inferior. They keep trying to suggest that this is some sort of subunit of the SEC. But, of course, that was the proposal that was rejected by Congress. So, no. The point is that every freestanding agency, from the Legal Services Corporation to the CPSC to the FTC, all of them are principal officers who are appointed by the president and removed by the president. So frankly, I don't think anyone ever envisioned this notion of having this agency with its own statutorily defined authorities not being subject to the direct appointment and removal of its heads, wholly apart from separation of powers concerns, because they are principal officers, since they are not directed and supervised by anybody else. So I would think that, no, the appointments clause problem would solve that they would all be inferior officers. And of course, unlike the independent counsel in Morrison, this is a permanent agency with extraordinarily broad authority.
That was my next question. How do you distinguish the, Just on the temporary versus permanent, is that how Morrison is?
I think there's four reasons actually. Well, one is yes, that this is a permanent with extraordinarily broad regulating the public interest. I submit respectfully that if what was at issue in Morrison was the Independent Counsel Corporation, where Congress had tried to take all the criminal enforcement responsibility away from the Justice Department, that you would have had an entirely different result. But removal is the other issue. There, the Independent Counsel was obliged to follow Justice Department policies unless it was impossible to do so, and she could be removed for cause if she didn't do that. So the President, at least in broad strokes, had the ability to form policies that the Independent Counsel was obliged to follow. If you put those two things together, what does it mean? The Independent Counsel's only authority was to apply General Justice Department policies in an even-handed manner to presidential cronies. And that's the third big distinction. There was an inherent conflict of interest in Morrison versus Olson. The president would have had to recuse himself in any other situation. So there was a burning need, a burning reason to remove this power from the president and his those over whom he exercised political oversight. They will not be able to come up here and give you any reason that there is any kind of conflict of interest or reason to suspect that a traditional independent agency or the SEC itself couldn't exercise the board's function in just as effective a manner. There's no conflict of interest that's remotely comparable to what was going on in Morrison v. Olson. And
if the SEC could remove the board members at will, would your problem wouldn't be entirely solved from your perspective?
Well, we need to distinguish. Obviously, it wouldn't solve the Appointments Clause problem, right? Because that involves appointments and not removal. No, it wouldn't solve my separation of powers problem for this reason. While it is true that a Chris Cox subordinate removable at will solves my problem, again, it's important to understand that every power that the subordinate, the SEC, exercises is derived from the commission. Here the board has powers that are given to it by Congress, right? So even if you make them removable at will, how is the SEC going to direct them to do something in terms of investigations and inspections? They don't have any statutory authority to tell them how to conduct investigations and inspections. In other words, removal at will says, if I tell you to do something and you don't do it, I can fire you. But the first steps that's required is that I have the authority to tell you to do something. And you can scour the statute and not find any SEC authority to tell them how to conduct investigations and inspections. So removable at will doesn't enable them to control the board because they don't have the power in the first instance. But having said all that, that would obviously go a long way towards solving the separation of powers problem.
Do you wish to have any time for rebuttal?
I have saved 3 minutes, and I'm at 3:24. Okay. So my final point will be, if you allow this unique model to go forward, there is literally nothing to prevent Congress tomorrow from taking all the functions of cabinet agencies, transferring them to corporations like the PCAOB that are overseen by these bipartisan multi-member commissions. And the board agrees with this. They say, yeah, that's true. Well, maybe you'd have to tweak something if they were purely executive, but of course, that doesn't mean anything. The leading cases are NTUU versus Reagan and Perkins, which involved the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of the Navy. Well, if that doesn't fall within purely executive, I don't know what does. So at the end of the day, they're simply asking you to trust Congress, which the Supreme Court has repeatedly instructed is not an acceptable separation of powers. Thank you.
All right. We'll hear from Mr. Lampkin, representing the board.
Thank you. May it please the court. Plaintiff's constitutional challenge rests entirely on the mistaken premise that the board is somehow an independent agency under or apart from the SEC, which is itself an independent.
Well, it's not
agency.
Subject to at-will removal.
No, Your Honor.
And that's because, and traditionally, when Congress makes entities subject to for-cause removal, the entire purpose is to make the entity independent, either from the president, to some degree, from the president or here from the SEC.
Well, even apart from the fact that the removal here is for cause, the mechanisms of control are pervasive. I should back up and for a moment say many employees are
for cause.
The
history in this area, as you well know, is the distinction between at will and for cause is critical.
Absolutely not.
And this, let me ask you this. Your brief says there's nothing novel about this. Are you aware of any inferior officers in independent agencies who are subject to for-cause removal?
Any inferior officer who happens to be civil service protected would be subject
officer,
to removal.
Officer.
Yes. Meyer makes clear that Congress can make inferior officers subject
to... I asked for examples.
I don't have any examples for
I don't
you,
think there are any.
I don't know
I don't
whether
think
there are
have
or not.
Been any.
To the extent that any of them are civil service protected, they would be. And Meyer makes clear, the high water of presidential authority makes clear that inferior officers appointed by department heads can be subject to civil service protected and thereby removed from politics. And the reason that makes sense is the very fact that they are inferior officers means they are subject to the pervasive control of a superior officer, a principal officer. And therefore, you don't have to worry about them because the superior officer is the one who controls their behavior. And
the board members here aren't civil service protected.
No, the board members here are subject to the SEC's pervasive and comprehensive control. For example, their rules are ineffective, except as the SEC allows. Their sanctions stand only as the SEC allows them to stand. Refusal to register, mentioned by Mr. Carvin, is treated as a sanction. And critically, with respect to inspections and investigations, the SEC has authority to remove, on a public interest standard, the board's ability to enforce the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. Now, if the Attorney General in Morrison versus Olson had authority to determine in the public interest that he wanted to take away Alexa Morrison's enforcement authority, that would have been a very uninteresting separation of powers case. For the same reason, this one is relatively easy as well. But it doesn't stop there.
Relatively easy, again, even
in
though...
In that respect,
even though, best I can tell, your brief, the Justice Department's brief, doesn't cite any example in the history of the Republic that is similar to this.
This is modeled based on a highly successful model of the self-regulatory organization.
Yeah, and that doesn't work because those aren't government entities at all.
That's right. And by
Congress here was operating on a mistaken premise from the beginning that this board wouldn't be a governmental entity, but in fact you concede it is, correct?
For statutory purposes it's not. For constitutional purposes it is. But the advantage of having this model is, first, you have a group of people who are dedicated and expert in a particular area and not subject to a distraction of competing concerns. But they are always subject to the SEC's comprehensive oversight and control, as this court itself recognized in NASD versus SEC. To go on with the examples, the board's budget controlled by the SEC.
Can the SEC direct the board to conduct an investigation that the board doesn't want to conduct of a particular entity?
It certainly could informally, upon pain of potentially removing the investigatory authority, and it could promulgate a rule which does just that.
Informally?
It could direct them to do that. There's not a specific mechanism. Nothing prohibits them from doing it. And the board knows quite well that if it does not regulate as the SEC wishes,
would failure to follow that informal direction be for cause for their removal?
I don't know whether it would be or not. I think if the SEC followed up with a rule.
You don't know whether it would be or not, it's kind of a hollow promise.
On the contrary, the SEC has taken the position it can promulgate a formal rule under which it can direct the board to start and stop investigations. The board's entire budget is controlled by the SEC. The board cannot get a subpoena except one given by the SEC. The board cannot litigate in court except with the SEC's consent.
Subpoenas are only necessary for third parties, right? When they do demands to the actual regulated entities, they don't need a subpoena.
That's correct, but that could only be enforced by a sanction, which is subject to the SEC's comprehensive plenary and de novo review. The board cannot enforce compliance except as the SEC chooses to allow it. It can remove all of the board's authority and it can impose reporting requirements to watch everything the board does. The notion that the board here is somehow independent in any way, shape, or form, the SEC.
Why are they subject to for-cause removal instead of at-will removal?
Your Honor, because the
SEC. What do you think the congressional purpose there is?
Your Honor, I don't think there's anything in the record that gives an answer. They followed the SRO model, which has similar provisions. And because the board functions and has adjudicatory functions, the Congress may well have determined that it was appropriate, just as with the SEC, to have a for-cause removal standard. For example, in Edmund itself, there was a restriction on removal because the Judge Advocate General couldn't remove Coast Guard judges to influence how they conducted their cases. Coast Guard judges do.
The court emphasized in Edmund that it was subject to at-will removal.
The court said it was an important factor, but here the means of control are far more expansive than anything that existed there. That was a court that could issue final judgments that couldn't be overturned, except, for example, it couldn't be overturned if there was some evidence, for example. Here, by contrast, the rules and the sanctions are reviewed by the SEC de novo in its own assessment.
I understand your thesis. It's basically that because the board is literally subject in everything it does to the commission, therefore, the fact that this is a for-cause removal as distinguished from an at-will removal takes on less significance.
I think that's absolutely correct, and that's reflected in the Supreme Court's decision of Perkins. the plaintiff's principal contention here is that we know that it's good law that the president can have some restrictions on his ability to remove some principal officers, such as the commissioners of the SEC. And we also know that under Perkins, it's permissible to have some restrictions on the removal of inferior officers.
In Perkins, the distinction, and this is the key, the Secretary of Navy was removable at will by the president.
That's exactly the argument they're making. That if Humphrey's
right,
executive
right.
is good law.
And the distinction is, and again, the distinction is this is two levels of for-cause removal away from the president. Humphrey's executor, which is commonly thought to be the outer limit of encroachment on presidential authority, was one level of for-cause removal away. Never before has there been an officer that's two levels of for-cause removal away.
The principal argument they have is if you take Humphrey's executor and you put it together with Perkins, two settled precedents, you get bad law. But that violates Justice Scalia's admonition in Freytag itself that you don't go and adjust the remainder of the Constitution to compensate for Humphrey's executor.
So this is Humphrey's executor squared.
This isn't even Humphrey's executor plus, because the control over the inferior officer is absolutely pervasive. There's nothing the board can do that the SEC cannot prevent. And in terms of political accountability, if there's investigations that may remove the authority to conduct investigations and inspections, those are part of the enforcement authority.
It doesn't supervise the day-to-day operations of who the board investigates. That's just not
It certainly could. It could require the reporting of any investigation it conducts. It's no different than its control.
The statute doesn't contemplate that.
Statute doesn't require it, but the statute allows the board, allows the SEC to implement any rules it sees fit to ensure the faithful administration of the act. And in fact, it can adjust the board's rules for fair administration under broad terms. So it could adjust the board's rules to require the board to report to the SEC every time it begins an investigation. And to the extent that there's any debate about what the statute means, that's all the more reason why this case should not be coming up outside the established mechanism Congress created for challenging these types of, for raising these issues, to bring it up through the comprehensive review mechanism Congress established.
By the way, is the board a department?
Pardon?
Is the board a department?
No, the board would not be a department.
Well, then how are the inferior officers within the board constitutional?
Well, I don't believe there are inferior officers within the
chief
board.
Chief auditor is not an inferior officer?
They would most likely be employees if they're appointed by the board as opposed to the SEC. It is not a department. And you know it's not a department because a department is something directly under the president.
Yeah, I don't
the
think
board's
it's a,
not
I don't
directly
think it's a
under
department
the president.
Either. I think you might have a problem with your inferior officers in there if they're appointed by the board.
On the contrary, Your Honor, inferior officers, as Freytag and this court's decision of Landry point out, are persons generally whose positions are established by statute and their responsibilities are established by statute. Here, these individuals don't have their positions established by statute. They are personnel employed by the board. They are not inferior officers.
Don't exercise significant authority in the United States?
They might exercise significant authority.
In which case, they're officers?
No. In Freytag and Landry both make it clear that if that authority exists merely by virtue of a delegation by another officer and not by statute, it's very likely that they're mere employees. I see that I'm out of time. If I have no further.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hear from Mr. Stern.
May it please the court. I think just following up on Mr. Lampkin's discussion, with which we wholeheartedly, I think it is important to sort of go back and split up a couple of the lines of argument that are being pursued by plaintiffs in this case, because there tends to be a certain sort of back and forth between the general separations of power argument and other concepts that are particular to their appointments clause discussion. And on the appointments clause side, we've got the contentions that the SEC, that these are really superior officers. If so, they would have to be appointed by the president as being principal rather than inferior officers, and then we've got the argument about the department and the department head. The argument about the principal inferior officers turns on the analysis that's laid out most recently in Edmonds.
And Edmonds requires that the inferior officer be directed and supervised, and I don't see any direction.
Well, there's a lot more direction, Your Honor, with respect here than there was in Edmonds. I mean, there, I mean, Justice Scalia, is pointing out that
there they were at will.
Well, but that really wasn't, it's not irrelevant, but that really, as mentioned by the court, that's one tool. That's clearly, that wasn't the beginning and end of the court's analysis by any means. That would have been a very short opinion. That opinion,
the central part of the analysis.
The opinion is there, Your Honor, and we can focus. We can each take away from it exactly how important it would seem to the court. But what was important to the court was the idea that if you're being a subordinate means you answer to somebody else. I mean, that was the key point that was being laid out. And the proposition that is being advanced by the plaintiffs here, and they do so explicitly in their briefs, is that the board is essentially just like the commission. They say it's got the authority of an independent commission, and that's why they say these are principal officers who should be appointed by the president. But what's really clear about this, whatever one thinks about anything else, is that can't be true, because the SEC commissioners really are answerable to the president, but only the president. The board is,
well, they're subject, at least it's understood, though the statute doesn't say this, they're subject to for cause removal.
Well, they're subject to for cause removal, but first, to the extent that there's any question about exactly what any of these terms would mean and how the SEC would apply
them. Well, in the real world, they mean a lot. That's the whole distinction between the SEC and the Department of Defense.
Quite right, Your Honor. I'm just saying, to the extent that there's any dispute about what these terms mean, we're here on a facial challenge, and the statute cannot be properly construed to create constitutional problems rather than to avoid them. So if there are any uncertainties in here, given the way the plaintiffs have chosen to proceed, we've got to give the statute the benefit of the constitutional doubt.
Are you aware, either now or historically, of any other inferior officer in an independent agency subject only to for cause removal?
Your Honor, I was thinking about that. I'm not. I can look again to see if we can find one. I'm not, but let's
say, well, if it were out there, I think you probably would have.
Well, I probably would have, Your Honor, but though you can never tell. But the one thing that's clear is we really do know how this statute came about. I mean, it's not, as plaintiffs would suggest, a kind of odd power grab by Congress, sort of a naked grab, I think they refer to it as. I mean, we have for 7 years, and I understand that these are not governmental, these SROs in the same sense, but we have a 70-year history of these organizations that have done a really good job. And the
I guess my concern on that is that those are not governmental entities, and it seems here that Congress was actually operating. We can't even assume Congress wanted this structure had they known it was going to be treated as a government entity, because they thought the board was not a governmental entity, correct? That's written right into the text of the statute.
Well, they say that it's not a government agency. I don't think that they thought it was not going to be governmental, because we do know, I mean, there are a lot of similarities between the two. There are some differences, but leaving aside the appointments clause issue, because most of the arguments about the SROs go to the broader separation of powers claim, not to the appointments clause. And there, the question becomes, all right, the SROs are doing something that is they're under almost all the precise same kinds of statutory provisions, and as this court said, as are applicable to the accounting board, and as this court said in the securities dealers case, is of course they're exercising huge amounts of significant power, but it's power that's derivative of the SEC because it is in all respects answerable to the SEC.
If it were in all respects answerable, they'd be at will employees.
Well,
that's just not right. In all respects answerable, to use your terms, that is the language of at will employment.
Your Honor, I withdraw the all respects and just refer the court to the discussion. I don't, because I was just trying to characterize this court's decision. Certainly, they are subject to, I mean, the court outlines, you know, in very significant detail the ways in which the SRO's regime of sanctions and oversight are subject to SEC review. Now, those provisions are all, they're not merely parallel, they're cross-referenced in the statute. They're incorporated. I mean, this is, in large part, essentially the same scheme. The difference is, you know, that's being focused on is that the president, that the SEC appoints the heads of the accounting board, whereas it does not appoint the head, does not appoint the members of the SRO. Now, whatever one might think about that for appointments clause purposes, the idea that this is a diminishment of presidential authority and the ability to sort of exercise executive functions seems just exactly backwards. I mean, maybe it does add to the executive branch's authority. You know, maybe it doesn't. It certainly doesn't detract from it.
Well, do you think Congress could make the EPA administrator removable only for cause and then create a position of, you know, emissions czar within the EPA that was appointed by the EPA administrator and that person only be removable for cause by the administrator? Could Congress do that?
Your Honor, I've thought about these questions, and it's very – I know it's not a very satisfactory answer to say that there's no bright line, but – what the Supreme Court has told us over and over again as it's dealt with these cases, none of which, by the way, help ever come out on the side the plaintiffs are urging, even though they rely on them. What we have here, first, Congress can only, it only works for inferior officers who have to be subordinate. So that's the initial premise. You've got to, you can only, it's only, these can only be inferior officers.
If this were upheld, it would be a green light for all sorts of new creations, independent agencies within independent agencies.
Your Honor, that's certainly not how we're looking at it as a green light. We're looking at it as Congress responded and to, I mean, to the extent we're looking at separation of powers concerns, just in sort of that are not tied to any particular clear doctrinal point, but just the general notion of is the president's power being impeded, which is a very important question, and as Your Honor knows, it's a matter of very considerable importance to the Department of Justice, which, as plaintiffs correctly point out, is concerned with protecting presidential prerogatives, not just now, but over time. But when you see Congress looking, this is not a situation like Morrison v. Olson, where, I mean, the implications of the separation of powers there were very clear, though that statute was upheld. Here we have Congress looking to a particular history in a particular complex financial regulatory area. Congress has said, we've had these SROs. They have been exercising authority, derivative of the SEC, subject to SEC control for 7 years. We don't already have an SRO for the accounting board, but we're going to set one up.
Why didn't they create an SRO?
Well, because there was. I mean, that would have been a possible alternative.
Right, it created a new governmental entity, the problem being that it's independent in the sense of for cause removal, at least.
But Your Honor, I mean, there's also removal power by the SEC of the SRO members. I mean, it's not, you know, they don't plan to begin with, but they can remove them. And for separation of powers purposes, the idea that by proceeding this way, rather than say, well, we would ask the financial, you know, the accounting community to set up an SRO and provide for a registration by such and such a date, and if not, we will then impose this and try to get them to do it that way. That wouldn't be less of an intrusion into presidential authority. I mean, there's nothing gained by that. I mean, and what we have here is not some sort of broad overarching principle of what you can do, you know, sort of all over the place. You've got one particular action taken here against a very particular
background. You don't think this would be a precedent?
Well, Well, of course,
that Congress would use to create new entities within independent agencies that are independent of the independent agency heads?
Your Honor, speaking as someone who could be back here, like taking a very different position about a different enactment, I would say, no, this is not a green light to do anything of the sort. We've reviewed this very carefully, and if you look at each of the Supreme Court cases.
Well, we have to be careful because this is never, best I can tell, you've provided no examples historically of a similar structure.
Well, I would say, however,
zero.
Your Honor, that.
Zero.
Well,
in our history.
Well, we've got zero except for the fact that again, the SROs, we think in terms of exercising government power, which has got to be the important concern for the separation of powers aspect of this, have been there, and they are creatures of statute. We can call them self-regulatory organizations, but as this court said in the securities dealer case, these organizations wear two hats. They're a professional organization, but they're also a quasi-governmental agency.
Are they a governmental entity for purposes of appointments clause issues?
No, they're not, but
okay,
the appointments clause.
If that's true, and I'm not sure the relevance for the precise issue we have to decide.
Well,
here.
It's not relevant. It's not directly relevant for the appointments clause issues. It is relevant for the removal issues because they are subject to removal in this. There are removal provisions. At the real point, though, is the touchstone.
Are they a governmental entity for those purposes?
Well, Your Honor, it's the touchstone of this is not. Is that a governmental? I don't know whether you would affix the label governmental entity, but they are exercising authority under identical provisions that are at issue here. So whatever the label, and the SEC Commission can remove them, so whatever label we put on it, there is no doubt that important sanctions and rules, just like these, get issued. And when Congress wrote this statute, it goes through in section after section. It's just incorporating by reference the pre-existing regulatory scheme. So for the purposes of are you interfering with the president's authority to act, there the relevant that's where this is extremely relevant. For the appointments clause issue, no. The experience with the SRO does not answer the question. We're not saying it does, but we do think that on the appointments clause, there are lots of other reasons why plaintiffs' arguments fail. But on the separation of powers point, we do have something. It's not that really is right on point here. And to say whether it's governmental or not governmental when you've got them exercising substantially identical powers under the same cross-reference statutory provisions, one can't really say that it's unprecedented. So I think that this is
So the best precedent is a non-governmental entity.
Well, yes.
The best precedent for this board, which is a governmental entity in the history of the Republic, is a non-governmental entity.
Well, we can say that it's non-governmental, but we're looking at the same statutory provisions. So, I'm not trying to make a leap of an analogy. I'm saying these are, in so many ways, the same. These do accounting, that the securities deals, but these are the same. So, is it unprecedented? Well, yes and no. But the other thing I would say is that when it comes to precedents, to build a case that relies on a series of Supreme Court decisions that rejects various appointment clause and separation of powers challenges in cases that we would urge are far more difficult than that presented here, and to take those cases and to suggest that Morrison v. Olson makes this a clear winner for the plaintiffs when one looks at the way that the removal power, the appointment power, and the nature of the intrusion in that case that was at issue, whatever else you can say about Morrison v. Olson is, it does not indicate that the Supreme Court would look at that decision and go, well, that's pretty much controlling as a win for plaintiffs. That can't be right either. So we think that, in terms of an actual precedent, we've got the SROs. In terms of Supreme Court precedent, we think it's fairly well lined up squarely against the plaintiffs.
Squarely?
Pretty much.
You seem to be saying that analytically there's no distinction between these SROs, which are non-governmental and which do exercise some governmental authority, but it's the authority derivative of the SEC. And this board, which in fact has its own authority, correct? And why wouldn't we analyze those differently?
Well, when we say that it's derivative of the SEC, what, I mean, they have their own authority. What this court was saying is that because of the close comprehensive oversight, one should really consider that authority to be derivative of the SEC. And again, the level of control here really cannot be overstated. It's laid out again and again in our briefs. But I mean, the SEC really can come, not only does it review lots of specific actions, but it can rescind, it can tell the board, look, it has to approve its budget.
Does it exercise pre-approval of investigations and inspections?
No, but it could approve.
And investigations and inspections can seriously harm, if not put out of business, small businesses.
Well, I mean,
or at least harm the reputation.
Well, I mean, hypothetically, yes, but there are lots of things that lots of people, I mean, lots of things that, for example, an ALJ might do in conducting, and ALJs often have fairly broad powers that, you know, under various schemes. ALJs are not only not inferior officers, they're just employees. I mean, there are a lot of things that can be done, and, you know, by lots of people at different levels that have an impact. But the SEC can, I mean, it's got the power to say, you know, if you to pass a rule to say don't, and the rules don't have to all go through notice and comment, you know, not necessarily a broad, you know, delay. The SEC has the power to, by either by rule or otherwise, to stop the board from doing just about everything, and ultimately to say, we are taking away all of your authority, and we are going to do it.
The SEC hasn't enacted such a rule, correct?
It has statutory authority to take it away. I mean, and all the board's rules only become rules when they're approved by the SEC. I mean, this is... I mean, that's in the statute.
Rules, again, to focus on the investigations and inspections. There's no SEC pre-approval of board investigations and inspections.
Not at the present time. I mean, if there was a problem, the SEC could deal with it. I mean, again, the fact that one could posit a problem that could come up, you know, really can't be a basis for striking this down on an official basis.
At least the board, I thought, was arguing that the commission could require the board. There's nothing to prevent the commission from requiring the board to submit a list of these are the targets we're...
Yes, Your Honor, we agree with that.
And the commission saying we have to approve that before any investigation.
Yes, that's right.
Anything further, Mr. Stern?
I'm just asked if the judgment be affirmed.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Carvin.
Yes, very quickly, Your Honor. Now that the government sought to elevate this footnote to the rationale that there's somehow they can pre-approve board inspections, I think it's very important to look at the statute. 26A of the statutory addendum 107D2, which is 7217D2, tells you when the commission may, by order, impose limitations on the board. If it finds on the record, after notice and opportunity for a hearing, that the board is violated or is unable to comply with any provision of this act, or without reasonable justification or excuses, failed to enforce compliance. So it's not as if they can wake up tomorrow and say, we're going to impose these kinds of limitations on you. The board has to commit transgressions almost as horrible as that subjecting them to removal. So the notion that they can do it is absurd. The other point is, even if they could do it, what conceivable relevance does that have? They haven't done it. The board is exercising the executive power. It's like saying that a magistrate judge can decide Article III cases and controversies if you just add to the judicial code, well, judges could take over if they decide that the magistrates are not doing very well. The relevant constitutional issue is not who could take over the job if and when they decide to, it's who's performing the job. And since the board is performing this job utterly free from any restrictions by the SEC, that's the here and now controversy to be resolved. Finally, all they can do is stop them from doing stuff. That's not supervising.
Congress can stop the board or the SEC or any other agency tomorrow from doing something just by withdrawing their statutory authority. The question is not whether you can stop them from doing something. The question is whether you can supervise what they are doing. It's quite different to say you can abolish the Civil Rights Division is quite different than saying you can tell them which position to take on an affirmative action controversy or something like that. And that's the relevant point. The other point that appellants seem to make is, well, in Edmond, only they couldn't do anything that wasn't final without executive approval. Well, there were appellate court judges, and no disrespect here, but appellate court judges are passive instruments that can't affect Americans' lives unless they issue a final opinion. But prosecutors can affect people's lives in very serious ways without any supervision by the relevant person. So the difference between appellate court judges and prosecutors is dispositive, we would argue, in these circumstances. Finally, Mr. Stearns, lovely tribute to the New York Stock Exchange as being the model is one that, of course, we totally agree with and totally embrace. I can't imagine why they're making this argument, because everyone in this courtroom knows that no rational person thinks the president has a scintilla of authority to run the operations of the New York Stock Exchange. And by definition, since he has the same power to control the board as he does to review Mr. Grasso's pay and how they seat people on the exchange, it vividly confirms that he has absolutely no power to control the board either. So when we get a new president next year who's decided he wants to change the way things are done, he's going to be absolutely powerless to do it, because he's going to be sitting there with a corporation whose terms haven't expired and who he cannot redirect in any way, even if he thinks they're damaging the economy.
Of
and the
whatever sex.
Excuse me?
Of whatever sex.
Of whatever sex and or race. That's
all
entirely
right.
True. And I just, if I could just their final quote. I want to hereby adopt the government's characterization of this agency. It says that like the SEC, like the New York Stock Exchange, the government is playing a residual role in supervision. That's on page 40 of the United States brief. And we don't think that you can suggest that the president can play a residual role to a private corporation and still be executing the law.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement and take a brief recess. Stand, please. This honorable court.